All right, lots to get to here. We got to talk about LeBron's debut in Portland, where the Lakers seem like they never win, and that has continued. But first, let's get to a little news. What we got?
Well, so it happened a couple of days ago now. I believe it was on Wednesday morning that Mike Malone got an extension from the Denver Nuggets, a 2-year contract extension. Apparently, they were concerned about the potentiality of him being a lame duck. And
so he expired at the end of this year?
I'm not sure. Coaching contracts, because there isn't necessarily a sport track or whatever for it. I'm not, off the top of my head, I'm not entirely sure.
So usually it's a 4-1, right? So when was his first year? I want to say he's 3 years in already. Yeah, he is. Because remember, he like wasn't starting Jokic, and then Jokic emerged at the end of his first year.
This is his fourth season.
Yeah.
15-16 was his first year, yeah.
Okay, so this actually, and you never know too, like this could be a 2-year extension that, again, has a team option on it, you know? So, and the Denver ownership, never one to be particularly interested in paying a coach. And so, yeah, maybe this is just, all right, so he's not in a lame duck year. But when they talk about the extension, I thought it was going to be, you know, 3 years, 4 years or something, which seemed kind of crazy to me. But this is a little bit more reasonable if you subscribe to the idea that you should never have a lame duck coach, which I don't necessarily, but this is a decent hedge. Well, I mean, at least
it's a hedge. My concern with it is that the Nuggets, by virtue of the other moves they made, and overall, you know, the bigger scale stuff, Jokic, I have no problem with that signing, and the structure of the Millsap thing, that's the big moving piece they have left, is that they don't have a lot of things now that they can change if for whatever reason this season it doesn't work. There was a, you know, that idea, we talked about this in the coaching fired section of the preview podcast we did, and I mentioned all these guys where it's like, well, if it goes wrong, he could be one guy. And because other than the power forward spot, and because Denver doesn't have as much financial flexibility now that they signed Will Barton and everything else, so I thought maybe, you know, they could figure out that Malone is the answer. I think he has helped them overall, but you have these kind of two competing things, which is, one, it doesn't seem like he's one of those clear-cut value-added coaches, but those coaches are also incredibly hard to find. So it would not be certain that if they replaced Malone during the season, after the season, that they would necessarily find somebody better than he is.
Yeah, that may be the case. And this is, I mean, it is a pretty talented roster for a job that could come open. But I mean, to me, I agree with you. I mean, my view would be, all right, let's at least see how the first month of the season goes here. They got a pretty easy schedule. If things don't go well, then maybe you still have the option of moving on from him. But if the idea, though, is like this self-fulfilling prophecy, like that simply by not extending him, you're going to cause your team to play worse, which, again, I do not necessarily agree with. This is something that certainly could be studied empirically as well. I'm not aware if anyone has done that, to just look at what the performances of coaches who are in a quote unquote lame duck season versus those who get extensions in the same season. Even there, you're going to have some selection bias, because generally if coaches get extended, I mean, you would have to control for like what the team's record was before him. But it would be a way to at least get some information on this. I am not a huge believer in this idea that like simply by extending your coach, you're going to get your team to play better, or perhaps more accurately, to not play worse. And I just don't think Malone has earned it, right? And what you said, I think, is very interesting here. And we've talked about this a few times, where those really good coaches, the really value-added coaches, they are tough to find. And it's also kind of difficult to know exactly who those are going to be, although I'm starting to get a feel for it. I mean, I think we all kind of thought Kokoschkov is going to be good, and we'll see where he ends up, but he certainly looks like he's been pretty solid. We'll see what Nick Nurse is going to look like, although he certainly seems to have a lot of modern principles. I want to see what the Raptors look like this season. I mean, there are guys who come out of the coaching ranks who, as far as we know, have the right philosophies. You never know how they're going to work from an emotional standpoint, but there are also coaches who come out, and I think Malone is kind of one of these, who, you know, doesn't really seem to, he's kind of a taskmaster, a disciplinarian, a little bit of a hothead, you know, I mean, and certainly that's not to say that he's like, you know, these college screamers or something like that, but you do get a feel for like, all right, who's a progressive coach and who isn't. I don't know that Malone is that. And so, you know, I think he's a below average coach. I think we did our coach rankings, he's in the 20s somewhere. Maybe not a terrible coach, but he certainly does a fair number of things that seem pretty obvious they don't agree with. And they're not like they're some great defensive team, right? I mean, if you're just going to look at like what they've done, like what can you point to, like, oh man, Mike Malone has done an awesome job, and that's reflected on the court in this way, you know? So the idea to me,
and also some of the reforms that they've had have been through some serious pain. I mean, think back to all the time that Jokic played next to another big, you know, that wasn't necessarily, oh, Mike Malone saw something that nobody saw. I mean, Jokic is an amazing player, and they activated a lot of that by going through it. And some of the best things they've done have been kind of fought by Malone's instincts. And so I don't, you know, and something we should note, like, I off the top of my head, yeah, I think we did have him somewhere in like the 20s in that podcast, that coaching is better now. So there aren't as many, like, being in the 20s now to me does not mean the same thing as it would have, let's say, 10 years ago.
Like, I'm not saying he sucks, you know, or anything like that. I mean, there are some coaches who suck, and you're right. There are fewer of those these days.
But it is also important to note that they're maybe the modern principles, getting somebody who can activate a little bit more of their defensive potential. And so the reason why I wouldn't have done this is just because we still don't know exactly kind of where this team is going. Yeah. And also, I'm not completely confident in what they are relative to their potential. So is he really boosting them? Because you and I both love Jamal Murray. We really like Nikola Jokic. And then Gary Harris is a good player. And Millsap has done well when he's been on the floor, and they have, you know, their bench pieces are their bench pieces. And so I feel like there are other coaches that could do well with this lineup. And so I don't know what other jobs are going to be open this coming year. And I mean, we saw Budenholzer take the Milwaukee job. So it's not like, you know, good coaches are going to turn down opportunities with good talent just because it's not in a glamorous market or something. I think we're beyond that if the Cronkies are willing to pay for a coach, and that's another question.
Yeah, that might be part of it too, but to finish the point I was making, I sidetracked myself. Because there are so few good coaches and they are pretty difficult to identify beforehand, I think that almost means that you should fire more coaches when you have a pretty good idea that maybe, okay, you know, does Mike Malone deserve to get fired? Is he so bad that he deserves to lose his job? You know, we think of losing your job as so much different than like a player getting cut or not getting re-signed. We think, because losing your job is something that like the average Joe can agree with, right? You get fired or you get downsized from your desk job. They equate it to that as opposed to just like a player getting cut, right? It's like somehow those things are different. And there are a lot of people who would say, hey, you know what, like, I don't deserve to lose my job. I'm not doing such a bad job. But you need to take another swing to try and find that coach who is awesome when it's demonstrated, as I think it is with Malone, that, you know, he's average at best. And so they decide to keep him around. I probably would have moved on from him actually after last season when not making the playoffs, when he gave them some cover. But, you know, that wasn't what they're trying to do. And maybe that's money. Maybe that's just, you know, as a management, you want to have a feeling, you know, a veneer of stability, if you will, as well, that things are on the right track. If you fire the coach, you know, then that puts you, that's like another nail in your coffin potentially as a GM. So I don't know. There's a lot of dynamics at play here, but Malone is not.
So there's one other thing I want to mention, and it ties in with that, which is coaches' salaries are also not, like the salary cap doesn't matter and all that kind of stuff. So we've seen some NBA teams, as player spending is, you know, it's limited to a point. It's a soft cap, that facilities are getting better and all those kind of tactical advantages. Well, paying some money, dead money, to a coach that wasn't the right answer is kind of along those lines of something that you try, and it's not the same as throwing $2 million into a facility or something like that. But if you are confident that somebody is not the answer, that's another argument for it, because all it costs you is money, you know, money on that side of the ledger. It doesn't prevent you from signing a player or anything.
The big news of the day we can get to now. After we plug real quickly our ad-free podcast with our Patreon, patreon.com/DuncanLaRue. A lot of people have requested that, and we're going to see over these next couple of weeks whether we get more patrons and whether they want to sign up, and whether it's worth us to still have Liam do that, to post the ad-free. You actually get an RSS feed on Patreon as a patron, so you can just listen to it in your podcast player, but without ads. That could be another perk of the, among the many others of our Patreon. But the news of the day, the G League, John Gavoni reports, will for the first time next season have what will be known as select contracts. These are for players who would be one and done type of players who are coming up through this USA basketball system that have been identified as some of the best. There will be some gatekeeping here. Not sure exactly what that is going to be. There's a committee to work out the details of this, but basically these players are going to get $125,000 to go to the G League. And they also, of course, because they have turned pro, number one, they can get endorsement contracts of any kind, shoe money, etc. And number two, I mean, if your plan is always to do this, you could be getting that money even earlier in high school. So you could really, you don't have to worry about NCAA eligibility earlier in high school. Now, Woj did say he doesn't think that a lot of players are going to do it. And he did provide, I think, a pretty decent reason for that, which is these guys aren't going to want to go and get exposed. And he says you also can still get paid when you're in college. You're going to play at much better facilities in college. It's not as hard. And you're playing against other guys who, you know, are your age, or at least are only a few years older than you are. And, you know, while you may not get quite as good a preparation for the NBA, playing the pro game or being able to train at a pro level all year, that's one of the perks of this. Going up against G League players with the average age is 25, even with the G League a little more watered down than it was a few years ago with all the expansion they've had and will have, that's a concern. And I think we're going to need to see players go through there and succeed and get drafted, because you don't want to, you could average 20 a game in college and look good, or you can average 7 points a game in the G League. And it's like, well, what is the baseline for like looking like a good prospect in the G League? And it's also, it's just a lot more fun to like be the BMOC, and you know, you're not going to get life-changing money with this 125K. It's just decent, you know, if some are to be believed. It's commensurate with what you get paid if you go to college anyway. So I don't know, I've gone on long enough here. What are your thoughts on this rule?
To use a phrase you often deploy in a very different context, to me this is winning the press conference for the NBA. That's what they're trying to do here. I do not think this is as substantive, and my big it's not opposition to it, because I support having more options for players. But what I do not support is if this is part of the rationale for pushing back actually changing the age limit, which is the actual answer here. Because the big difference between the G League and a guy going there for 1 year and the NBA is incentives. Because a G League team has very little incentive beyond the kind of collective incentive to develop this player, to nurture them, to put them in a situation to succeed. Whereas if they were eligible to go into the NBA, that team has all the value in the world in it. They're tied in this guy, presuming they don't change the rookie scale contract structure. They have 4 years to figure out what they do, and then restricted free agency. And then they can put all these other processes to bear, which are already set up. Like, I mean, the league, if for people who read Boys Among Men, Jonathan Abrams' great book on this, the league wasn't really well suited to handle 18-year-olds then. I believe they're in a much better place now. And if they're using this as kind of a buffer, and that was something else that Woj talked about, was that they're not planning on incorporating the age limit until 2022 at the earliest. We had previously heard 2021 as a possibility. That is now apparently off the table. And the G League, just, they're not going to do that. I mean, these coaches have a lot of complicated things. And the biggest problem why this will always be a limitation is because there will never be a system in place where players play in the G League and then bypass the draft, because there's no way the 30 NBA teams would ever agree to that. And so then by having the NBA as a minor leagues, imagine if there was a baseball player who went into the minor leagues but couldn't go to that Major League Baseball team. They wouldn't develop them like it was one of their own guys, because there isn't a reason to.
I've been saying that for a while, and Dylan Murphy, who spent a lot of time in the G League, he and I talked about this on a pod last year about how not only do teams not necessarily have the incentive to develop a player who's not going to be around, but that most of these guys, really only the best of the best, are going to help you win games, even in the G League, just with the lack of physical development. I mean, someone like Darius Bazley is a good example here, and he's just going to sit out the whole season now rather than go to the G League. He had a rough summer, apparently it didn't really look good, and so he doesn't want to go to the G League and not play at all. He'd rather just remain more of a mystery. He was, I think, initially going to go to Syracuse, and that's a cautionary tale, to be sure. And you know, Bazley is, he was on the Nike Hoop Summit team. You know, he's probably, you know, the number 10 prospect or so by the consensus. I haven't looked exactly at what his RSCI is, but you know, so if someone like that really can't contribute in the G League to winning and isn't going to play, that's an issue. Now, there is an awareness of that. In Gavoni's article, they talked about how they're going to try to come up with a system here where they are going to have that incentive, and what that's going to be will be very interesting. I will say, though, that I think those teams do have it to some degree. Number one, they would just love to get the intel on these players to have them around. maybe there will even be an element of choice where, you know, the players can pick what team they're going to go to and what organization they're going to go to in some way, at least. So, and then, you know, these players are going to have agents by this time, agents who will have other clients. The team might want to just show them a good experience because, you know, they might have that player again as a free agent. And, you know, you just want to make a good impression overall. You want to establish yourself as having a good culture and good development as well. So I think, you know, and it's kind of bad press if you get this guy too who's going to be this awesome player and you don't play him. So I'm very interested to see what kind of a system they come up with here. This is also, I think, because the league finally to some degree is understanding that, you know, maybe college basketball is just taking money out of their pockets, and like, why not try to make some money off the G League if now every team is going to have this expense? Even the super cheap ones are finally getting there, because they just if only due to peer pressure, because it just looks so stupid to not have one at this point. So maybe they'll come up with a good system, but I completely second your point about, hey, why not just make it one and done? Now, they certainly didn't like have any sort of process in place for the 2006 draft when they just took away one and done and made that draft suck ahead of time. Now, that was probably unfair to not grandfather it in a little bit. And there is a thought maybe that, oh, you know, there's too many draft picks out there. It's not fair to those teams. But you know what? Like, you take on a shitload of risk with draft picks to begin with when you trade them. So
Known that this was coming for years. Like, that this possibility has been out there since even before the current CBA was agreed to. Like, this has been, it's kind of been out there, and they tabled it during those negotiations and everything else. So, and I heard, like, there were people in my mentions, because I was critical of this on Twitter, saying, oh, well, you know, maybe they're trying to be nice to the scholarship system or whatever with college. If that's true, then the NBA is making a major mistake. They do not need to feel bad for college basketball or anything else. They do what's right for them. College basketball will do what's right for college basketball, and that's fine. I mean, various people have made this point a lot. College basketball is more of a competitor than a contributor to NBA basketball, and there are lots of different ways that you can think about that, and so they should treat it that way, and there's no reason. I mean, they play at the same times. Sometimes they compete in the same media markets, depending on how it all gets structured, and it's crazy to me that they don't see it that way. But that gets into something else that I want to talk about with this, which is also visibility, because whether or not we think it should matter, visibility can often be important in terms of draft stock and in terms of endorsements. And so as of right now, the expectation has to be that players will get substantially more attention being a BMOC in college rather than playing in the G League when games are on YouTube. And I wouldn't expect that there's going to be some like TNT deal for G League games if they start getting these.
I could see it.
It would have to be a pretty big star. I mean, yeah. I think for that to happen,
it wouldn't get the same.
And also think about the travel workload.
Yeah, it wouldn't get the same audience.
Yeah, like
that's true.
Yeah, and so I think that it's a consideration. But you know what Bazley's doing is interesting, and the idea that being somebody of mystery, not getting exposed, but also just like being able to work on your body, work on your game without having to travel all the time. I think that's another benefit. And sure, getting used to something more like the NBA is there. But I mean, going to IMG Academy, Anthony Simons, basically, from what I understand, did that. But you know, as of right, depending on how immediately you need that money, and I don't know how agent payments work in that structure too. That's another thing that maybe if you know college is an option, you can structure it differently. But the answer here is just take away the goddamn age limit. So just do it already.
Also weird about this program is it's only going to be available to the players who are at least 18, but they have to be 18 by September 15th, which is not the same as the draft. You just have to have turned 19 by the end of the calendar year. So you would have guys who would be draft eligible the next year who wouldn't be eligible for this program, which is really weird and I think stupid. I mean, we've seen like, and who knows what's going to happen with European players and their eligibility for this. But, you know, some of the more prominent guys, I think Aaron Gordon was in a September birthday. He might not have been eligible for this. Giannis is pretty late. Dragan Bender, it was a late birthday as well. So there are guys who are very late birthdays who wouldn't be eligible, which it really makes no sense to me at all. A couple very small quick hitters here. Andre Iguodala with calf tightness did not practice today. Questionable for tomorrow. That means he's not going to play. Almost certainly, I would imagine. Cavs can linger, and the Warriors have no reason to push it whatsoever. And then Devon Reed, who was cut, was not claimed on waivers. He will sign a two-way with the Indiana Pacers. He got cut out of Phoenix, the number 32 overall pick in 2017. All right, we got some games to talk about. But first, this could make tomorrow night's games really fun. And that's DraftKings. Their one-day fantasy basketball is a great way, especially in those big league pass days. Your Wednesday, your Friday, Saturday. Sundays are fun, too, because the games are more spread out, so you can actually watch all of your players those days. And with DraftKings, it doesn't matter what your skill level is, because there's actually a contest waiting for you there. They have contests, for example, that you can only enter if you've played for less than 50 contests, and they're going to have over $400 million in prizes throughout the NBA season. Long-term fantasy basketball, kind of tough to do, especially just having to manage your roster every single day. With DraftKings, you get a fresh start every day. It's that one-day aspect that really appeals with daily fantasy. You can download their app or head over to DraftKings.com and use my code CAPSPACE. Easy to remember, we talk about CAPSPACE all the time in the program. And play for free with your first deposit. Get some of that $400 million in total prizes that'll be up for grabs throughout the season. That's code CAPSPACE to play for free with your first deposit only at DraftKings. Minimum $5 deposit. Eligibility restrictions apply. See DraftKings.com for details. All right, we got to start with the Lakers here. It was a crazy fast game, 128-119. These teams were on pace for 117 possessions before things slowed down at the very end of the fourth quarter. The key stretch, it was 101-100. Lakers had gotten back into it, and Dame Lillard hit an impossible step back three over pretty good defense from Lonzo Ball. Then Zach Collins with a huge block of a ball layup. That led to a Nick Stauskas three. Stauskas had probably easily the best game of his career, dropping 24 points on only 13 shooting possessions and hitting his first six shots, including 4 of 4 from downtown in an incandescent performance in the first half. And the Blazers were able to roll from there. I thought the biggest thing, though, was that they really were able to clean up the easy points that the Lakers were getting in the second half. They had 50 points in the paint and 65 points overall in the first half. And they finished with only 70 points in the paint. So they really shut that down in the second half. And with the Lakers shooting 7 of 30 from 3, that was enough. This crazy fast-paced game actually really was not a great offensive game for the Lakers. It was only about average overall.
I think one of the other takeaways from this game, which is not exactly a surprise to those of us who had feelings about the kind of the second half of the Lakers offseason, was the emergence of players that are semi-buried by veterans. I mean, I thought Josh Hart meaningfully outplayed KCP and Lance Stephenson, ended up getting more minutes than both of them. Technically, we had 10 seconds more than KCP. And also the Lakers troubleshooting now. I do not think they're going to miss their first 15 threes very often, but there are a lot of players on this team that you don't necessarily worry about taking, much less making those shots. And so that will gum up the works for a lot of the other players on this team. I mean, you talked about this, and I mean, it was pretty easy to see that there were possessions. The Blazers are a smart team. They are a well-coached team where they would just help off of Lance, help off of Rajon Rondo, and that narrows the space for their guys to work. And there are differing levels of success for the Lakers, but if they're going to be in the playoffs, if they're going to try to win a playoff series or two, they need to be ready for teams to adjust to those sorts of players.
Yeah, I'll get to some of that stuff in a second. I wanted to try to keep it a little broader, at least for my initial takeaways. The Lakers offensive system, given their personnel, is pretty damn good. I thought, really, like, they do a lot of operating through the elbows. They do, LeBron with his height is such a good passer that any kind of screening action under the rim, whether it's hard cuts, whether it's a flex cut, if a guy just even gets open for a second, he's going to dime that guy up and get him a layup. And so the Lakers did do hard cuts. LeBron had some hard cuts as well. Rondo is obviously a great passer. Lonzo only had one assist, but he's an excellent passer as well. So the Lakers ultimately finished with only 23 assists, but they also are running some really nice split cut action in a different way from what you normally see. And you'll normally see, for example, Golden State get the ball into the post and then do split cuts. That really only works if you have one of those guys that's a really good shooter who can pop out and shoot and then use the threat of that shooting to set up the back screening action. Instead, what they love to do is get the ball to someone near the free throw line at the top of the key in a two guard front and then have guys cross over and sprint to the basket off of that action. And so when it's someone like LeBron, KCP is really fast, Lonzo is really fast. Like, if you can get, you're starting your cut from all the way out by half court, give the ball up, and then just start sprinting immediately, and you actually can get a real nice advantage going to the rim. They had some good plays off of that a few times. So I will say that I think, you know, the touch time is not available yet, but I thought they moved the ball around pretty well. And I think that Luke Walton already, from a stylistic standpoint on offense, has implemented more of a system than basically we've ever seen for a LeBron team. And now down the end, they did try to run a few small pick and rolls. We can talk about that later. And it'll probably be more the LeBron show in the last 5 minutes of games, but it was not the LeBron show today at all. Maybe it should have been more of the LeBron show, frankly. But you know, I thought just stylistically, I liked what I saw from the Lakers, given again the limitations of their personnel. And they did actually get up a fair number of 3-point shots in the end. 33 pointers is a decent number to get up. They just couldn't, you know, they're 0 for their first 14, and then finished 7 out of 16.
And from the Blazers' perspective, I think one of the more interesting and you could argue surprising takeaways from this game was what they got from some of their bench guys. I mean, Stauskas is 24. You already brought up Zach Collins had some of the biggest defensive plays in this game. He had a series of big blocks. He ended up with 6, but I mean, it was throughout the game. But then he was on the floor late instead of Yusuf Nurkic, and I thought he did a nice job overall. And then I was surprised to see Mo Harkless playing. It wasn't expected. He did come off the bench and only played 18 minutes, but I was still happy to see him out there. And the Blazers are going to need all of that. I thought there were moments when Seth Curry looked pretty good. He's very confident in his shot, and that can help out as well.
He looked fast too. I thought he looked like the same guy I remembered, which is always nice to see when a guy's been off injury for a year.
Right. So I think that the Blazers can make those elements work. And once they move Harkless back into the starting lineup where he belongs, then that will help some of their defensive integrity. I was thinking in this game about how Neil O'Shea not valuing small forwards has really come back to bite them. And I was thinking about, like, oh, they drafted Caleb Swanigan. They drafted Gary Trent. And
what are you talking about? He values Jake Layman. he guaranteed his contract when there was no reason to do so. Although he did have a nice summer league after that. And Layman got the Keith Bogans in both halves.
And it was also, I mean, one of the ideas of not bringing back Ed Davis was that Zach Collins would be their backup five, but Myers Leonard still played in this game. He wasn't, you know, he didn't really do a ton and grabbed a couple of rebounds. Actually, he had 4 assists. I didn't even realize that. I think some of it was just moving the ball around to guys and them getting shots. But it was weird for me at moments to see him on the floor. Maybe they'll just straighten out some of those rotations. And, you know, that happens over the course of the season. You don't expect a team's opening night rotation to be exactly what's going to be in game 70, much less game 82. So we'll see how all that works. And going back to the broader points of this game.
Can I say a few things more about the bench before you turn?
Oh, sure, if you want to.
So Harkless, 18 minutes. He played well. He had 3 blocks. He was part of a big run that they had, but kind of looked to be laboring a little bit.
Guys coming back too early from knee injuries is not something I like.
Well, and he obviously, we talked about this before, he did that last year and he's been struggling with that knee all through camp, and it still just did not look great. Like, he didn't look very comfortable out there, even though, you know, he still was able to provide some serviceable minutes, some good minutes on LeBron. And then the other big experiment for the Blazers this year is they've long basically played 0 minutes without either Lillard or McCollum on the floor, and they went in another direction from that. This year they played those guys mostly together, and they have this second unit with Curry and Stauskas at the guards. You know, Evan Turner, it does a lot of the ball handling with that unit as well. That is a way to take advantage of Turner a little bit more, since neither Curry nor Stauskas are really point guard types. You know, and Collins, as you mentioned, played really well. He closed for this team. So it was the first, you know, and now it helped that a lot of those minutes came with LeBron off the floor. But even when LeBron came back in at the start of the second and fourth, those guys didn't just get completely destroyed. So that was a good start. It'll be interesting to see how that trend continues throughout the year.
So what I was getting at with the Lakers was how aggressively they ran in the early part of this game.
That's another aspect of Walton, really, you know, another system thing that he's implemented with LeBron that we have not seen before.
And one of LeBron's bigger highlight dunks was actually running off a make, one of my favorite things for teams to do when they have the opportunity. I mean, you do worry a little bit about running your guys a little bit ragged, especially in the season when their conditioning isn't all the way there. But the Lakers have lots of guys to throw at these circumstances, so they can, you know, they can go to some different lineups. And I just, you know, I love seeing LeBron and a lot of the other guys in a more up-tempo system, because it opens things up. And especially if your team is limited in shooting, if you don't have to get into those circumstances where it's compressing the action, it can really help.
Yeah, and I think this is a team that, as talented as they are, is really going to be reliant on other teams' mistakes, not getting back on defense, overcommitting to the offensive boards. We saw, especially in that first quarter, they really were turbocharged when Nurkic would go for the offensive glass and couldn't get it. McGee runs the floor pretty well. And obviously LeBron, they get the ball out of the room quickly, even off of makes to confuse the defense. And then in the half court, it's all right, are you going to screw up with the communication on these cuts? And you know, are you going to fail to not guard the right guys, right? And the Blazers really cleaned that up in the second half, where they didn't guard Rondo. There's two plays early in the third quarter that sort of showed what the strategy was. Like, hey, remember, this is Rajon Rondo. And Rondo actually hit a couple of layups early on, and so I think they started overcommitting him a little bit. There's one play where there was a pick and pop, and they just left Rondo, and Rondo went baseline and ended up getting scared by Nurkic and missing the layup. There's another time where there's a curl in the lane. Rondo had a wide open three in the right corner. They let him shoot as well. And then Lance Stephenson, they really stop guarding him in the second half. And Lance, really, that's one of the ones that just, he's the one who's made no sense at all for the team. He and Beasley too, who hardly played at all. But Lance, like, you're gonna play Lance for 16 minutes and Lonzo Ball 19 minutes and KCP, who admittedly had a terrible game, 27 minutes, and Josh Hart 27 minutes. Like, how about you just give all those 16 Lance minutes to the three guys who are better and also happen to be the three guys on this team who actually will at least take a three-pointer? Because Lance, I mean, the signature play was he's in the left corner being guarded by Evan Turner. They get the ball to LeBron at the elbow, run a nice back cut. It would have been a dunk. And Evan Turner, 25 feet away from his man, runs over and blocks an alley-oop dunk when his man is in the left corner because it's Lance Stephenson. That happened a number of times. The hilarity of Evan Turner and Lance Stephenson like guarding each other and basically not guarding each other simultaneously. And especially Turner, just because he's a smarter defender than Lance, just, you know, the irony there of like, oh yeah, I don't have to guard this guy, just like they don't have to guard me. You know, I thought it was pretty funny. But yeah, having Lance out there, you know, especially Lance comes in, he takes three shots in his first minute of action, basically. It's like, what is the point of this guy on this team?
It was definitely striking. Something else that stuck out to me at certain moments in the game, not the whole thing, but especially Josh Hart had no fear driving on Nurkic and finishing over and around him. And I mean, Josh Hart's a strong dude, and it's not a surprise, but there was also like one play where Rondo went right after Nurkic. And so I was skeptical a lot of last year. I mean, I trust Dot's scheme, but this idea that the Blazers were holding opponents to a ridiculously low success rate at the rim, and the Lakers are going to put more pressure on the rim than damn near anybody because of the way the passers they have and some of the finishers they have. But I want to keep tabs on that throughout this season. And I mean, we already saw some of the dynamic between Nurkic and Collins. Collins was better in this game. Collins played more in crunch time in this game.
Yeah, Nurkic actually sucked in the first half defensively. I mean, he really, maybe it was just worrying about fouls, but he was just totally like, guys are just going right through him at the rim. At Hart is a good finisher, but like, you know, he actually was pretty effective at the rim last year and just was not able to do that this time. He played better in the second half a little bit, and he had his typical okay offensive game, 16 points on 15 shooting possessions for him, six offensive rebounds and a lot of fast breaks given up. The Lakers did have 34 fast break points in this game, and they also really pressured up on the perimeter a few times defensively. You got some steals, but when they weren't able to get steals, I wasn't too impressed with their overall defense. Yeah, Hart is awesome. KCP, I thought, had a really bad game, not only with only 5 points and three shot attempts, but more just that he was not his usual self defensively. And he's been slowed with an injury, you know, some knee soreness in camp, and just by all accounts hasn't had a good camp. He did start and play 27 minutes, but he just had a huge play where he lost CJ McCollum for no reason, and he hit a three in the late clock in the fourth quarter and just wasn't getting through screens, wasn't providing the same pressure that he has generally throughout his career. He usually pops off the screen with how quickly he's moving on defense, how quickly he's closing down the space if he does get screened off. I just didn't see that from him tonight.
And one idea I had was, because I've liked KCP guarding point guards a fair amount because of the way he can navigate screens, and was playing KCP and Hart together because you have LeBron running the show offensively. And maybe we'll see that at some point this year, but we didn't see much of that in game one.
What do you think is the best lineup for the Lakers? What would you go to?
Are we counting? Well, so I think the definites are LeBron, I mean, obviously. And Ingram had a nice game. I thought he did a good job defensively on CJ, and his length just
I thought it was better than good. I thought he really frustrated McCollum.
Yeah. Yeah, that's sure. I will say that too. And offensively, it's still kind of relying on Ingram making jumpers, and I still don't completely trust it. I mean, a talented guy, but that shot is going to be a big bellwether
for his
career.
A lot of long twos for Ingram.
And
he's still, you know, he's really gotten to be pretty good getting to the basket, going to that right hand with his hesitation dribble or in transition, but he doesn't really seem to be able to go left still. And there just isn't a ton of space at the rim on this team when they're not in transition. But I think, you know, a few too many long twos. I also didn't really like the rotations for Walton in that respect, where, you know, he had Ingram playing a lot of his minutes with James. I'd like to see him get more of a chance to handle the ball on the second unit. And you know, Ingram, 16 points on 15 shots, 0-4 from three. I want to say that all of his shots came from the corners or close to it. And LeBron also was 0-4 on threes as well. But and only one assist for Ingram, only one assist for Lonzo Ball, as we mentioned. That's not amazing. And the Lakers, despite the fact that I thought they moved the ball around in terms of time of possession, 23 assists is not an amazing number. 23 assists on 45 field goals for the Lakers is not so good.
Two other things I wanted to mention on the Lakers worth tracking for a lot longer than this. When they went to some of those small lineups, my biggest concern with it has not been, people talk about the rebounding, and there were some foibles that they had on the defensive glass in this game. But for me, the way that you attack a team that's playing small that doesn't have, let's say, Draymond Green at center, is getting to the basket, because they don't have help defenders, they don't have rim protectors. And so there were a couple times late when Dame got by his guy, and then there was just no resistance. There was nothing there. And so if the first line of defense isn't strong, you can get a parade to the basket. And that's a concern that I have about some of those lineups when they're playing LeBron and Kuzma at the four and five, however you want to define terms between those two guys. And there aren't many teams who have a 6'8" guy, 6'9" guy. And LeBron, when he's engaged, can do some of that stuff, but it's never really, you know, it's a little bit of a different role that he's occupied. And so I want to see how those lineups rebound, and I want to see how they project the paint.
Yeah, getting back to the idea of what their best lineup is, I think it's more really, and we've said this many times, end of games, playoffs, sometimes it's more about just not having any weaknesses. And, you know, if you have guys who can't shoot or you have guys who can't guard, you know, those are the two things that I think you really need to avoid at the end of games. And so to me, I would say there, if you have JaVale McGee out there, you know, you're not going to be able to guard someone like Dame Lillard in a high pick and roll, especially if it's Rondo. So I thought Rondo actually gave more defensive effort in this game than he normally does, even in the post a little bit. And I think having LeBron on his team is good for him there. He even like had a couple of nice ball denials that short-circuited some plays, but the Lakers, you know, do provide some pressure. I thought that was a big part of why they improved defensively last year. But, you know, Rondo and JaVale, you're not going to stop anyone with that pick and roll defense combination at the point of attack. You really can't have JaVale out there at the end of games, especially against someone like Lillard. They had to take him out. And then if you go with Kuzma, he provides a shooting element, although he was 1-7 tonight, but really as a switch defender, inadequate, the difference between like him and Ingram trying to guard CJ McCollum on a switch, like McCollum was getting great separation. He was getting great looks. The couple of times he got matched up on Kuzma, it wasn't many, but enough to give you the idea that, you know, Kuzma really could not stay with him, not to mention someone like Lillard. So what does that leave you? And then Rondo can't really shoot. Stevenson obviously can't shoot. So what does that leave you? It leaves you probably Ingram, LeBron, KCP, Hart, and then I think Lonzo Ball. I think that would be, and Ball, at least, you know, the one good thing that he did was shot the ball okay from three in this one. I thought his jumper looked a little bit more compact, a little bit more normal than I remember seeing from last year. So that was probably would be my closing lineup against a lot of teams. You got the ability to switch with that group, unless you have, you know, like a huge Giannis Antetokounmpo type of guy. You've got all guys who are pretty locked in defensively, who are smart, as much shooting as you can really get with this team. So that would probably be my option, but I think, you know, they're a long way away from getting to something like that, it seems, with some of these other guys that they brought in, and you know, I think that's kind of a problem.
It will take time to figure this out. And there are some fundamentals here that I really, really liked, especially if you think about the next team, you know, the 19-20 with the offensive elements that they had in place. You're like, oh, if they have better personnel, if they figure all this stuff out, they'll be a much better team. You know, if they, whoever they sign in free agency, if they separate out some of the chaff on this team, I think that there's a lot there to like, but it's going to take some time to get there. And so that will make the Lakers in some ways more compelling to watch this year, but also more frustrating because it will take some time. And, you know, there's a chance that there's certainly a chance that we're wrong on how this mixes and how this fits together. But I think today was a data point that, especially with guys like Lance Stephenson, indicating that the veteran additions are more ill-suited than the holdover young guys.
The other thing I'll say too is they tried to do the small ball pick and rolls that have so bedeviled teams playing against LeBron, but they tried to do it with Rondo. And the reason that play works is because if you try to double team LeBron, then you've got a shooter popping to three, a J.R. Smith, a Kyle Korver. And if it's Rondo, he's not going to pop to three. They did have one time where they got him the ball on the move at the free throw line, and Rondo's a decent decision maker, but he's not really a threat to just come down the lane and score it. And so you really, like, I'll take that situation when LeBron's running a pick and roll. So I don't think that he's really a great option to run that play either. And so again, if you're not going to have the ball in his hands, having him out there at the end, it could be pretty limiting. And I will say, I'll give Rondo a lot of credit in terms of like his ability to shoot, like compared to where he was, say at the end of his Dallas tenure, like he's actually evolved pretty well. I mean, he's shooting more at the rim these days. He's taking more threes. He's making more threes. He's actually tried to work on some of his weaknesses, I think. But those weaknesses are certainly still there. And, you know, at the end of games, it can be taken advantage of. Anything else on this one, or should we move on? We don't have to do quite as much on these other two games since they were not as exciting. I really wanted to talk a lot about what we were able to learn from the Lakers today.
I think we can move on, but I'll let you choose which of the two games you want to start with.
Well, you watched a lot more of this Miami Washington game than I did. I watched it more of Philly and Chicago, but let's talk a little bit about this 113-112 Miami victory. I could talk a little bit more about the last 5 minutes because I did lock in on that, but what were your overall takeaways on this game, which saw Miami in the first back-to-back of the NBA season come away with a brutal Southwest Division victory?
Southeast, but
close enough.
I once made that mistake on when I was for one of the division podcasts for Real Jam Radio, so I'm attuned to it. But a lot of this game just kind of went to form, where Miami's defense eventually kind of broke down some of what Washington was doing well. They started out strong. John Wall came out, hit some shots, and physically, I thought he looked better than I expected, which is great. That's such an important part for John Wall. You know, he's still 1 year away from getting into that extension, right? Because he had 2 years left on his contract. Am I remembering that correctly?
Yes, he bumps up to $37.8 million estimated to start next year.
Whee! Yeah, because it depends on where the actual cap gets it. So at that moment, you're like, okay, maybe Washington's really starting to figure it out. And then partially it started when Wall came out of the game and it was backups versus backups in Miami, even without a bunch of players that we expect to be in the rotation, like James Johnson and Deion Waiters. They still were able to execute, still able to make life hard. And they got a career high scoring night from Josh Richardson, 28 points, 8 of 21 from the field, 5-11 from 3, 7 of 8 from the line. And some of the free throws he got were a little bit dubious. The fans were more skeptical than I was, but that's what happens with a home crowd. And I think Magruder's 20 were either, oh no, it was Derek Jones Jr. that had a career high. He had 17. And he looked like a natural fit for Miami, yeah. You know, super athletic, can compete, all that. And the other kind of big takeaway for me with this game is I trust Miami's defense, you know, pretty fully, entirely. And offensively, you could see times where it's going to ebb and flow. Dragic looked rough for significant portions of this game. And you could talk about it in the last 5 minutes, but there were possessions where Wade looked good, but then, you know, his instincts are still generally really strong. And so sometimes he makes plays that other guys just wouldn't even really be in the mix for. Like he gets a rebound that's kind of out of nowhere, and then he's able to get it to a teammate. Like there was one where he got the ball and swung it around to Olynyk. That was really nice. And those guys will have those moments, but they don't really have a lot of other things to fall back on in terms of creating the initial seams. And so they're probably going to have a little bit too much on Richardson's plate offensively for me to really trust them on that end of the floor, but their defense is still awesome.
Yeah, Wade, 9 points, only 2 free throws, and 12 shooting possessions. So pretty ugly efficiency from him overall, and Dragic with that 3 of 18 was pretty rough also. But to get 65 combined points out of Richardson, Jones, and Magruder, Richardson took a ton of shots last night too. He was very inefficient from two, but it went 5 of 11 from downtown, was taking some threes off the dribble. He's definitely looks to have expanded his game, and even turnovers have been a big problem for him in the past, but he actually only had 2 despite the high usage. That was impressive. For Washington, Yan Mayhew,
I had one other thing.
Sorry.
Yeah, that's actually where I wanted to go, was that so Dwight Howard did not play in this game. And that led to, so you're kind of sitting there going, well, what's Washington going to do with center spot? Mahimi only played 12 minutes, though I think a lot of that was not due to intention. That was just due to, surprise, surprise, Jan Mahimi committed a bunch of fouls. We've seen this movie before. It happens. Jason Smith was the only other traditional center that played any minutes. Thomas Bryant was technically active but did not play in this game. Smith played 15. So what they went to a lot was Markieff Morris at center. And, you know, I think they did pretty well overall in those lines. But something that was striking was in the late portion of this game, even though they were playing Markieff at center, Eric Spoelstra kept Hassan Whiteside out there on the floor. And I think he did more harm than good during those minutes just because he wasn't providing as much value defensively.
Yeah, I saw you tweet about that. I did watch those last 5 minutes. I didn't actually see them get any buckets when he screwed up. There was one pick and pop three Markieff got that was wide open, but you know, I'm not that worried about a Markieff Morris pick and pop three. We've been waiting for him to make the three ball consistently for his entire career. I actually thought it was Josh Richardson who broke down a couple of times in the last 5 minutes where he just, Brad Beal just made cuts without a screen and just beat him twice for layups. One was a beautiful pass from John Wall when they're setting up a screen and then Beal just went backdoor on it. But still, you expect more from Josh Richardson. And with the Wizards, with Markieff out there, we're switching everything. Miami was not able to get good shots down the end. Miami is a very switchable offensive team. They don't really have anybody who can beat one-on-one coverage at this point. They don't really have, you know, Spo is a good coach, but they don't really have that type of system where, you know, they're going to get quick hitters off of switches. They don't have that type of recognition. So I was not impressed with the shots they were able to get down the end, but they did just enough. Josh Richardson was able to hit a big three off a conventional pick and roll coverage when they went under on him. Then he was off kind of a scramble situation, able to get to the rim, got some dubious fouls, as you talked about. And then Washington, the one time that Whiteside probably didn't help, which you may have been thinking of, I'm guessing, was when he switched on to John Wall in the last minute of the game and gave up those free throws. Is that what was sticking out in your mind?
Yes, it was.
Yeah, but he also actually blocked Bradley Beal on a drive in the last five minutes, too.
Well, and then the other part with Hassan Whiteside is that he's not exploiting anything offensively. Like, you're not going to throw the ball into Hassan Whiteside and have him beast on Markieff Morris or anything like that. So
he's
sometimes
very switchable.
That's the advantage created by center.
Yeah, yes. Whiteside is not like a good enough post-up guy, and he's a great pick and roll man, but if you're switching, it kind of takes that away, and he's not going to be like, oh, they're switching, I'm going to like sprint hard to the rim and like beat this guy there and get an alley-oop. You know, he's pretty slow. But I still maintain that he's going to play better this year than he did last year, and I didn't think he was awful when he was out there, but Spo made the big sub by going to Kelly Olynyk at the end. Olynyk getting the offensive rebound off of a Dwayne Wade fadeaway. They tried to do which is becoming a common one here, the inbound the ball to the elbow and then the fake handoff to induce some confusion with the switch, and then, you know, fake the handoff and then dribble to the rim. But the Wizards were all over it, switched it perfectly. Wade had to take an impossible fadeaway, and Morris just did not really box out on Olynyk. He never really looked to hit him. He just kind of let Olynyk run in right next to him, and Olynyk, amazing rebound and then great fundamentals to hold the ball up. If he brings it down, he probably A, doesn't get it off in terms of time, and B, might have gotten stripped. So he held the ball above his head, and he's got great touch around the rim and hit the game winner with 0.2 remaining.
And it continued a storyline from this game because Kelly Olynyk was persona non grata in, I don't know the name of their arena right now, because of his issues with Kelly Oubre back when Olynyk was a member of the Boston Celtics. And the fans were booing him consistently throughout this game. And something that was amusing, I guess you could say, to me on that last play was there was a foul. I mean, from what I could tell, Rodney Magruder basically grabbed Otto Porter and threw him out of the play on a play that, unless a ref sees it straight on, they're never going to call. Because it's just, you know, it's the scrum. But even if that, you know, that foul existed, Markieff Morris still could have put a body on Kelly Olynyk and made that harder. And then the foul wouldn't have mattered nearly as much. And so I'm sympathetic because there was some, you know, some untoward action involved in the play. But if Markieff Morris does his job, they're going. And also another factor in that play was there wasn't much time. So if Olynyk didn't get such a clean look at the rebound, he might not have even been able to get the shot. Either as good a shot up or a shot at all.
Couple other interesting notes here. Jeff Green was actually in the closing lineup. He played 33 minutes in this one, third most on the team, but had an excellent game. 17 points. He had 8 points in the fourth quarter, went 2 of 4 from downtown. So it was a good Jeff Green day and his homecoming. We'll see if that's going to continue. It's not. But, you know, he played more than Oubre. Austin Rivers had an okay game with 25 minutes. He played more than Satoransky, who was basically used as the straight backup to John Wall. He only played a couple of minutes alongside Wall in this one. Anything else on this one before we move on to Chicago and Philly?
Well, I'll mention briefly that I was excited to see Bam Adebayo grab and go a little bit in this game. It's something he did in summer league both years, and he should have full license in Miami just because then everybody else can run forward, and sure, he should be passing it to somebody else if they want to attack, but that's something he brings that Hassan Whiteside does not. After game one, Hassan Whiteside 3-0, Hassan Whiteside assist 0.
An important update. Also noteworthy, we mentioned the Wizards' small lineup. The Heat stayed big pretty much at least with one traditional big man the whole time, and they killed the Wizards on the offensive glass. It was quite apropos that the game was won on an offensive rebound, because 40% offensive rebounding, 22 offensive rebounds for Miami against that small Wizards lineup. And John Wall had a pretty nice game. That was good to see. 26 points, 9 assists. He was efficient as well, got to the foul line a fair amount. All right, let's get to Philly and Chicago. The Bulls came out. It's going to be a different Bulls season. 41 points in the first quarter. Zach LaVine, Bobby Portis, 11 for their first 12. Completely unstoppable. And LaVine would remain unstoppable with 30 points on 11 out of 19. But the Bulls just got completely shut down in the middle two quarters, and the game was over halfway through the third. Also facilitated by the Sixers going back to the real lineup with J.J. Redick starting the second half, and that lineup predictably completely destroyed the Bulls. You don't need to get too much into the nitty-gritty here. Marco Fultz did hit some jumpers, hit a three-pointer in the fourth quarter that looked okay. He turned down a corner, wide open corner three early in the game that had the Philly crowd not pleased with him, and he finished 5 out of 15 overall. But how much of this game do you see? I know you watched Wendell Carter Jr.'s performance early. I know you didn't see as much of this one, but what did you see from him in his first quarter stint against Joel Embiid?
I still like a lot of elements of his game, just the way that he's intelligent, and there were some moments where I actually wish he would have been a little bit more aggressive at moments, because his jump shot's not bad, but he got into some foul trouble with Embiid, and that's not a surprise. I mean, Embiid's a very tough guy to guard, and Carter picked up one quick one. As soon as he picked up the early one, I think it was in the first like 4 or 5 possessions of the game, I'm sitting there going, oh, this is going to go badly, because then he, you know, it wasn't quite blonde coat or anything like that, but he couldn't be as aggressive as physical with Joel Embiid, because getting that second one, you know, then you're coming out of the game. That's an automatic for, you know, it's kind of like when you're in college or any of those sorts of circumstances. But overall, I thought he was fine. I think it'll be a good learning experience for Wendell Carter.
That's precisely what he said after the game, that it wasn't his best.
Yeah, it is.
And it would be a learning experience.
I think the biggest takeaway for me from this game was the continued offensive success for Zach LaVine. I mean, he's looked really good on that end of the floor. You know, defensively, it might not come around yet, but if he can be a reliable offensive engine, it looks like it's still more creating for himself. But hell, if you can create 30 points for yourself off of 22 shooting possessions, I'll take it every day of the week.
Well, and the big difference to me for LaVine, even last year when he came back from the ACL, he couldn't finish, but he actually was getting to the rim and the foul line much more than he did in Minnesota. And now, you know, he's playing in a much more modern offense than he was back then, with the more modern personnel. At least the Bulls put guys out there who can shoot generally. But, you know, he was only 2 out of 7 from three, and he was hitting some tough threes. You know, the two that he hit were off the dribble, and you know, you have to certainly have to guard him off the dribble, and that makes him very difficult to guard. He's got that higher release, he can get it off. But for him to go 9 for 12 on two-pointers and really get to the rim, he had a beautiful finish over Embiid. He's finishing more powerfully. You know, I don't know if he's quite the same athlete as far as just like the ridiculous dunk contest dunks, but the thing that was always so frustrating about him was he's such a good athlete, but he's that, you know, doesn't really get to the rim very much. He actually wasn't a great finisher as well when it wasn't a dunk, and he wasn't actually able to dunk that much in the half court. It was just kind of full court, you know, showtime type of stuff. And that's really changed. You know, he has filled out his body quite a bit since that ACL injury in Minnesota. He's able to go through guys, got to the foul line in this one. So, you know, the early returns, he still is horrible on defense. Don't get me wrong. He's like them trying to find place to hide him was hilarious against the Sixers team, because it was like he had to guard JJ Redick, which is a complete joke. Like Zach LaVine might be the absolute worst person in the league to try and match up with JJ Redick at the shooting guard position. Or he had to guard Ben Simmons because they also had Campaign out there. Chris Dunn was in Chicago for the birth of his child. Campaign. Kendall Gill on the Chicago Bulls affiliate said basically the Campaign experiment needs to end. He was 0-for-4, just did have 5 assists, but, you know, was negative 18 at 0 points. And, you know, he's not making up on defense when he weighs about $160 as well. Bobby Portis had a really nice start to the game and then predictably cooled off. I mean, Portis is a skilled offensive player, although he never, ever goes right shoulder. He has a really nice right-handed jump hook. Good three-point shot, can get on the offensive glass. He's an active cutter. I think he's actually like a solid offensive player, although, you know, he doesn't generate quite that many good shots to like really be efficient, you know, but, you know, he can create offense for you. I think he's much better cast on the second unit, but he's terrible defensively. You know, he and LaVine gave up a number of dunks. Bobby Portis was actually trying to guard Ben Simmons at one point, and two dunks and two possessions later, he was not guarding Ben Simmons anymore. Jabari Parker playing in that facilitator role off the bench didn't really get a chance to do much of that, get out and transition much, only had one assist, and, you know, a very Jabari Parker-esque efficiency line with negative 14, 15 points on 16 shots. I did like just a little bit of what I'd seen from Antonio Blakeney, who was on a two-way last year, had a full NBA contract for this season. And Blakeney, who's a teammate of Simmons at LSU, a year probably neither of them would like to remember, he's a decent shooter, but I just wanted to note that he really pops athletically, you know, even as like a 6'2 guard, but, like, you know, that carries over from summer league. Like, he actually looked like a pretty damn good athlete out there, even at the NBA level. I don't know, you got anything else here, or should I just continue to ramble on with my observations about the Sixers?
Well, one thing I'll mention is that Arch Diacono ended up with 8 assists, but 5 of those came in the fourth quarter when the game was basically over.
He's not an NBA quality point guard. I mean, he's pretty much like a wallflower. I mean, this game had 18 minutes of garbage time, essentially.
And remember that partially it was as a cap clearing move, if memory serves, but I mean, they basically dumped Jaren Grant on the Orlando Magic, and they have no point guards other than Chris Dunn.
That created the space to sign Parker. For the Sixers, it was back to reality, kind of in a good way of like, oh yeah, this is what this team is against three quarters of the league when they're not going up against this awesome Boston Celtics defense. Joel Embiid continues to look like a beast. I know he didn't have the greatest efficiency line against the Celtics, but his post-ups looked a lot better going against Wendell Carter and Robin Lopez. 30 points, got to the foul line for 14 attempts. He was 6 out of his first 7 and had 16 points at the end of the first quarter, and that's a change for him. We haven't seen him put up that many lines. You know, he's kind of more of a usage guy, you know, league average efficiency, maybe a little better than that. We haven't seen him put up these lines of, you know, 30 points on 14 shots, you know, and he also had 4 blocks. He was just completely patrolling the paint after that first quarter when the Bulls were on fire. And they really could not get anything going offensively other than LaVine in this game. And, you know, I think with Markkanen back, maybe that changes. It was very clear how much they need Markkanen, and just the threat that he provides is like a really good three-point shooter. Ben Simmons, triple-double. And with how fast the pace is around the league, like, I could actually see him averaging a triple-double this year. I mean, so the pace was 108 in this game, 109 in the Wizards-Miami game. And as I said, it was on pace. I don't know what the exact number was eventually, but on pace to be 117 in that Blazers-Lakers game. And that's like almost, that last game is like 1960s level. Like, they are averaging 120, 125 possessions a game back then. And so you can see that if this happens, I mean, and remember, probably even like the Warriors led the league in pace, I think, in 2014-15, and they were like 100 possessions a game. And now, like, the average game so far this year has been like 106. Like, that's insane how much things have changed. We've got, part of it is getting a bunch of new coaches in, guys who love to bomb from three. And, you know, I mean, the Warriors have really just changed the way that NBA basketball is played, it seems like. And even when the Suns came in, like, pace would increase a little bit, but it wasn't this drastic. I mean, it's Like the if this holds throughout the entire year, the average pace of the game will have increased by like 10 possessions in like less than 5 years. And that's insane.
And you can think about all the impacts that will have on counting stats and everything else. And so yeah. It'd be people who fetishize triple doubles, scoring totals, all those sorts of things will be there. And that's part of the reason why it's good that a lot of that has turned to rate stats and turned into balancing things by possessions, because that helps moderate some of these impacts that if you just look at the like 127, 108 type scores that you won't be reflected necessarily.
Yeah, I mean, the Bulls put up 108 points in this game and scored at a level that would have been by far the worst in the league last year, below a 100 offensive rating. So, it was pretty close. I mean, it was right at 100. So, all right, that's about all I got on this one. Anything to talk about before we depart here?
The Twitter NBA show. That's what we should talk about.
Yeah, we're going to do that tomorrow for Raptors Celtics, which I cannot wait for, in Toronto. 5 o'clock Pacific tomorrow, 8 o'clock Eastern. So we'll do that. And again, I tweeted this out during the day today, getting some good questions. 15 and 60 on the East. Sunday night, we're actually going to do one mailbag question for each team. And I think that's going to be a lot of fun. Our first time trying that. We really wanted to do a 15 and 60, but there's not really enough yet in terms of like statistics. It's probably not even really possible for us to see a full game of every team by Sunday in the level of detail that we'd like to. So instead, we will be doing this and, should be fun. What about on your end? You got anything to talk about with The Athletic? TheAthletic.com/capspace.
I'm working on a series of pieces basically on the broader scale of the 2019 offseason, but I don't know if any of those are... I was actually working on a piece today on all the guys that I think could be max players next year. So that'll be... I don't know when it's coming out. I'm guessing it'll be early next week, Instinct. And then also Real Jam Radio probably will come out over the weekend. I'm recording it tomorrow, but I don't know how much time I'll have to edit it because we'll do the Twitter show tomorrow.
All right, talk to y'all next week.
You must love hoops if you're enjoying another great episode of Dunked On. The Locked On Podcast Network has more hoops for you. Locked On has a podcast on every NBA team. If you're a Lakers fan, a Bucks fan, a Celtics fan, or a Mavericks fan, the Locked On Podcast Network has a daily podcast on your favorite team. All 30 NBA teams have a daily podcast at Locked On. Search on Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, for Locked On, your favorite team, or tell your smart speaker to play podcast Locked On, your favorite team. Locked On Podcast Network, your team every day.